Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host the webinar, Courthouse Steps Oral Arguments, EMD Sales Inc. v. Carrera, featuring Michael O'Neill. Our moderator today is Cheryl Stanton, Chief Legal and Government Affairs Officer at Brightstar Care and former administrator of the Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Cheryl, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Marco. Thanks for having us and for putting on such a great event. I am excited to have all of you here join us today. Thank you for joining. I want to introduce you the real star of the show, Mike O'Neill, who is the Vice President of Legal Affairs and the Barbara Olson Legal Counsel at Landmark Legal. He is also the author of numerous amici briefs, including one for the National Association for Wholesalers and Distributors and International Food Service Distributors Association in a case that we're going to be discussing today. That case is EMD Sales, Inc. versus Carrera. And just to put in perspective, the question presented in that Supreme Court case, quote, whether the standard of proof that employers must satisfy to demonstrate the applicability of an FLSA exemption is a mere preponderance of the evidence, as six circuits hold, or clear and convincing evidence, as the Fourth Circuit alone holds. End of quotes. So with that, I'd love to start by asking you a question, Mike. This seems like a really narrow question presented, especially because it centers around the outside salesperson exemption. Why should the general public care about this case?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. First of all, we're talking about exemptions in general to the FLSA, to the FLSA's mandatory overtime and minimum wage provisions. And so it's not simply just limited to outside sales individuals who function within that exemption, the outside sales exemption capacity. It's all of the exemptions within the FLSA that are posited. So you have not simply limiting the proper applicable standard of proof for outside sales positions, you have all of the exemptions under the FLSA. So it's really just broader. It's simply broader than that, just narrow provision. Also, I think what you're going to have here, and oral arguments kind of bore this out, and some of the briefing bears this out, is you have really the broader question of applicability of standards of proof in general. When exactly are courts to apply the clear and convincing, in civil cases, of course, we're talking about civil cases, let's set aside, obviously, criminal cases. But here we're talking about when should courts use the higher standard, the clear and convincing evidentiary standards, or when they should apply generally the kind of backstop, the default standard, preponderance of evidence standard, which of course is a lower evidentiary standard. So I think it's important for a couple of cases. And I think you're going to really have possibly just based on listening to oral arguments and reading some of the briefing, you're going to have probably some discussion about applicability of standards of proof and their utilization in civil contexts generally, and then of course applicable to these exemptions for the FLSA. Oh, you're on mute.
We talked about the fact that you filed a brief, an amici brief in this case. What was the position you took in your brief? And can you flesh out your arguments a little bit for us?
Yeah, sure. Again, as you said, we filed the brief on behalf of the National Association of Wholesale Distributors and the International Food Service Distributors Association. And we took the position, really, we wanted to expand upon the argument of what is an outside salesperson and why was this exemption established by Congress back in the enactment of the FLSA. We really took the opportunity to expand and talk about the unique and important role that outside salespeople play in the broader corporate context and why there was a need for this exemption. Furthermore, we kind of wanted to link into some of the discussion from Encino and show that really Congress had an intent to place on the same level these exemptions as the rest of the FLA's provisions. So we wanted to really highlight the importance of these exemptions and this particular, and we took the opportunity to talk about why an outside salesperson is important. Just to boil down and expand upon our arguments a little bit, we really said, look, outside salespeople should not be subject to minimum wage and overtime provisions. They have a unique set skill set. They're out in the field. Just briefly talking about what we talk about in our brief, we say, we did some extensive interviews with people in the industry. What is an outside salesperson? What do they do? What does their typical workday look like? And to boil it down, their typical workday looks like its own day. It's unique. There's really no typical workday for an outside salesperson. They can get up at 6 a.m. to meet sales calls and have meetings at 7 or 8 a.m. They can get up at 10 a.m. to have a golf meet, to have a golf appointment with a potential client. So a lot of their work really is kind of independent and unique. And subjecting these individuals to an overtime provision is really unworkable. And furthermore, if the court were to hold that you're going to apply this higher standard, you know, this clear and convincing evidentiary standard to these exemptions, the damage it would really do in the industry. And, you know, to boil it down, what it would do, it would be serious damage. Employers couldn't have outside salespeople function the way they function and the way they need to function in order to be profitable to the businesses and also earn a living for themselves. They couldn't do this if they were subject to overtime provisions, because some weeks you'll see an outside salesperson work 20 hours and the next week you'll see him working 70 or 80 hours when they're trying to develop clients. It's really no easy way to do this. And if this higher evidentiary standard were to be applied across the board, right now it's only applied, as we'll get into a little bit later, it's only applied in the Fourth Circuit, but if it were to be applied universally, employers would really have no choice but to eliminate these outside sales positions. The exposure would just be too great. And essentially what they would do is either they eliminate these positions in toto, or they would convert these to independent contractors. And you would see really a kind of deleterious effect across the industry. And then it just really was going to be unworkable or unattractable from a corporate standpoint. So we wanted to present that perspective in our brief.
That's wonderful. And I think that probably was very helpful in the court in it, looking at this case and how to analyze it. I will say you're singing my language. You just cited what was one of my favorite cases when I was at the wage and hour division, the Encino case. Do you mind taking a minute explaining to our audience what is Encino is about and how it applies to the issue at hand in this case?
Yeah. Encino, again, I think it was 2016, written by Justice Thomas, a 5-4 decision. But what it did was the court rejected the Ninth Circuit's conclusion that the FLSA exemption should be construed narrowly. And again, what it said is, it said, look, if you're going to read these exemptions, you have to read them in the exact same way you're going to read the rest of the FLSA. And you can't narrowly construe these exemptions. And Encino Motors, let's just talk about briefly the facts on that. That involved service advisors in car dealerships and whether they were subject to the overtime pay requirements. And these service advisors, as part of their job, would sell products to individuals. And this was an important and necessary exemption. So what it did was, it said, look, Congress intended these exemptions to have the same, you're to read these exemptions the exact same way you read the rest of the provisions in the FLSA. You aren't to narrowly construe these exemptions. Essentially, you're to apply a plain meaning rule. The court really, I mean, to get into it a little bit, they rejected the distributive canon of interpretation, the statutory interpretation, and that. And it was also kind of, I think, one of those formulation cases which led ultimately to the rejection of the Chevron. We're not really to defer to a DOL regulation regarding how they're going to interpret this. We're going to have to actually get back into first principles, look at the statute and say Congress means what it intended it meant.
That's great. You know, you and I talked in prepping for this that we thought it was interesting the position that the government took and the role they played in this case, both at the briefing and oral argument stage. Do you want to talk a little bit about what they asked for and why you think they asked for it the way they did?
Yeah, I think, and this is kind of, we've been engaging in some speculation here, because there was on the paper some inconsistency. Again, let's break this down, step back for a second. First of all, you had your petitioner and your respondents, but the government actually weighed in here as an amicus too. And so essentially in oral arguments, and we'll get into this in a few minutes, you had a 2-1 situation. You actually had the government on the side of the employer here, which I thought was a unique perspective. But the government, I think they argued for reversal rather than vacator. And they wanted, and this I think that the court, and we were talking about this, this would have involved with this, they didn't want, I think they didn't want the court getting into an actual analysis of the evidentiary record of here, of the facts on the case. They wanted to say, look, and I reread the oral arguments this morning. I reread the government's brief, and they wanted it clean. They wanted to say, look, in these sorts of cases where there's statutory silence, where there's monetary damages, where it's not a constitutional issue, the default evidentiary standard is to be applied here. And that's, of course, to apply, you're going to apply the lower default evidentiary standards, preponderance of evidence, as opposed to the clear and convincing evidentiary standard. Now, I also wanted, I had another thought this morning about this too, and I was thinking, okay, you want to have consistent application here. There was a lot of talk in oral arguments about, well, OSHA or FLSA or other Title VII cases are all litigated under the lower evidentiary standard. Why should these cases be litigated under the high? I'm sorry, NLRA, not FLSA. Why should FLSA cases, these exemption cases, be litigated under this higher evidentiary standard? And I thought, of course, you want to have even application of this. And there really was no. And again, we'll get into this in a few minutes when we try to dissect oral arguments. There really wasn't a motivating and a necessary and an argument that the respondents were able to proffer to justify that. They weren't able to say, hey, look, the FLSA is unique. It's so special. It justifies this higher evidentiary standard. So I think what the government was really getting at here was a uniform application of the evidentiary standard across the board. Unless, of course, we have those carve-out exemptions where there's, you know, when you have constitutional issues or where you have issues where the statute actually prescribes an evidentiary standard. But I think you also had, Cheryl, as an expert in this too, you also had some interesting thoughts on this. If you want to venture those, we're willing to hear. That'd be great.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I was really struck by the fact that they asked for the summarily, which I can never say, reversal in this case, and really seemed to not want this court to get into the facts of this case. I think the Solicitor General's office in particular, probably to your point, saw the writing on the wall. Why would this area be a different, or what appears to be the writing on the wall, a different standard than everywhere else? I think there was a little bit of worry too for the government that if the employer had to be proving by clear and convincing on their side, was a court going to flip that on the government and eventually ask them, to your point, to also prove by clear and convincing some parts that they had the burden of proof on? But I think the biggest takeaway I took was they did not want this, do not want this court to do a analysis of whether or not it was harmless error or anything along those lines, because they did not want this court to go in and analyze these facts against this law and create what would become Supreme Court precedent or stare decisis, rather than just letting it go back to the Fourth Circuit and be one of many circuit decisions. So, you know, a bad facts make bad case law for right. The government's position on the exemption, I think, was the concern. You know, where do you think this clear and convincing evidence standard from the Fourth Circuit came from? It does appear to be an outlier. And so, you know, what are your thoughts on where that came from?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And it was, again, it was broached at oral argument too. And we actually had one of our research fellows here dive into this poor guy. He started here, I think, in July. And one of his first projects when we were writing this amicus brief, I said, hey, look, I wanted, where does this come from for him? Where did the Fourth Circuit get this? And this poor guy is one of his first assignments. He said, there's no easy answer for this. And they delved into it at oral arguments, as I just said. And it ostensibly, it arose from a case 30 years ago, I think in the early 1990s in the Fourth Circuit, which was relying on a Tenth Circuit case, I think from the 1980s, where, and it's interesting that the Tenth Circuit actually corrected it subsequently, I think in 2012, and said, hey, we didn't mean it, but the Fourth Circuit didn't take a clue from what the Tenth Circuit had done. But essentially, the Tenth Circuit case in the 80s, and the name is escaping me off the top of my head, really involved burdens of proof rather than standards of proof. Who had the burden here in this case? And there was some throwaway language in this Tenth Circuit decision, which you could interpret somehow kind of missing the forest through the trees, saying, look, this case was involving burdens, not evidentiary standards. That said, that somehow, some way, contorted reading that there is that you're to apply the clear and convincing standard in these FLSA exemption cases. And so again, the court the Fourth Circuit relied on this in a 1991 case and has actually rejected two opportunities, en banc petitions, two opportunities to rebuke that or reject that standard. I don't know why the Fourth Circuit has been digging in their heels on this, but somehow they've been digging in their heels. And now, of course, what's happened is the case has managed to get in front of the Supreme Court. And, we'll get into the speculation of the outcome of this in a little bit. But as you pointed out, the Fourth Circuit really is the outlier. And I think that that's something that the respondents have to really contend with and that they're facing an uphill battle on this. I think there might be six or seven other circuits that utilize the lower standard in these exact cases. So the question, of course, is why should you be applying the higher evidentiary standard for litigating these FLSA exemptions in the Fourth Circuit as opposed to in the Tenth Circuit or the Sixth Circuit, particularly considering the Tenth Circuit actually reversed the case that the Fourth Circuit relies upon. If you could follow that, I know it's very contorted. Going back to this poor gentleman I had who had to do this research, he came across this way. It's like, Mike, I have no idea. This poor, his first assignment here, and it's an impossible task. We all know as lawyers, right? You're given some impossible task as your first job. He's not a lawyer, he's a legal fellow. And I had the poor guy running in circles, and I didn't know, quite frankly, between all of us, I didn't know the answer at the time either. So I kept pushing him over and over again. Hey, it's got to come from somewhere. It's got to come from somewhere. And the guy he had to try this contorted like way of finding where the Fourth Circuit's reliance is. Just incidentally, the question did come up. Justice Kagan raised a question on it in oral arguments. And I think what she was looking for is, hey, where did this arrive from? She was looking for reassurance that it didn't come from any kind of Supreme Court precedent. So the takeaway, of course, is that, yeah, the Fourth Circuit wasn't relying on any Supreme Court decision for this. It was relying on a Tenth Circuit decision, which was misconstrued in the first place.
That's great. Thanks for that explanation. Just a reminder to all of our folks in the audience, if you go down to the Q&A function and want to ask some questions in that box, I'm keeping an eye on that. We talked a little bit about the respondent's position. Do you want to give a high level explanation of how the respondents try? Because you and I have talked about outlier, doesn't seem consistent. We've really harped on this, on what makes it was the petitioner's position. Tell us a little bit about the respondent's position.
Yeah, and I said, just let's preface this with saying that I think the respondent had an uphill battle. They were dealt a really difficult hand of cards to try to play here in this case. First of all, start off with the basic organization of oral arguments. You had a two on one, and so you know when you're going to have a two on one, it's going to be a lot more. You're going to have a lot tougher road to hoe there. You're arguing not only against extremely experienced counsel arguing on behalf of the petitioners. You also have the Solicitor General's office weighing in against you too. You're going to have a tough situation. So that's the first principle. And then number two is, what are you're arguing here against? Really, you're trying to carve out and say, why is the FLSA special here? Why should the FLSA, these exemptions, be read in such a manner as to obligate employers to meet a higher evidentiary threshold when they're trying to assert these exemptions? And that is, as we said, that's an outlier. So you're trying to argue an outlier. And I think, counsel for respondents did a fantastic job playing the cards that she was dealt. She argued waivability, which I think was probably one of the things she said. Look, let's distinguish the FLSA from Title VII, for example. Rights under Title VII are waivable. Rights under the FLSA are not waivable. So that shows congressional intent to elevate this in importance. Ergo, it shows that we can justify a higher evidentiary standard for these exemptions. Imbalance in the equities in the litigants here. You say, look, employees versus employer. This is oftentimes employees who are trying to assert these rights, assert these rights so that they're entitled to it. Obviously, the burden's not on them, but they are at a disadvantage versus their employer. So the employer already has a built-in advantage here, and subjecting the employer to a higher evidentiary burden is going to be an effort to really balance the playing field and put the litigants on an equal footing in front of the court. So I think you've got that. You had your public policy arguments, you have your waivability arguments. I think those were really, they kept going back to it. At one point, I think counsel for respondent was making the case of the uniqueness and the importance of these rights that kind of got her a little off footing, because I think a lot of the justices kind of jumped on that, saying that these are really important. The FLSA conveys important rights to employees, and these rights are special and unique and necessary. Therefore, we need this. Going down that special and unique important rights kind of opened up a box for the justices, where they were kind of jumping in and saying, well, rights under any statutory rights are important from the point of view of the litigants. But so waivability and social policies, I think, were the real arguments that were proffered by the respondents in this case.
Before I get your read on how oral argument went, we do have a question from the audience as to whether outside salespeople have to work outside, putting out that in the modern era, many sales are typically done by phone now. So you said your brief was very heavily written about that. So why don't you dive into that for us a little bit?
Yeah, I think there certainly is that part. There is that where they are. There is the virtual aspect. But I heard from a lot of people in researching our brief that a lot of it has to do with one-on-one customer interaction. And it's not just necessarily over a Zoom call or over a telephone call. It's actually going in, meeting with the individuals, touring, you know, finding out what their needs are, visiting their employer, their place of business, to actually get in. You could do so much over the phone. You could do so much virtually, but actually showing up, walking around, seeing what the customer needs, walking through their building, walking through their place of business, maybe identifying things that you wouldn't necessarily identify on a Zoom call or on a scheduled Zoom call. Also, a lot of it has to do with just, you know, a lot of these relationships are developed, you know, in your off hours. You know, I think we pointed out in our brief, the good outside salesperson will develop a relationship with his clients outside of the work professional context. And so, you know, we have instances where outside salespeople will vacation with their clients. And so you're on and say, okay, I've developed a relationship with a client. I'm also their salesperson. We go to the beach together. Our families go to the beach together. Am I supposed to carve out the time when I'm selling them versus the week we spend at the beach versus the time that I'm playing golf? Or, you know, it's all of this kind of amorphous relationships that it really, really begets a successful outside salesperson. Initiative is really necessary. So, again, you're right. Back to the question raised back in the 1930s when this was passed, you know, we had back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, you had, you know, your traditional traveling salesman. And a lot of times I understand that that's kind of gone the way of, you know, that's an old school kind of way to approach this, but there still is the role for the personal interactions. And the clients we were talking to were really, really keen on stressing that and getting that before the court.
You point out so many challenges we have in understanding the FLSA in 2024, when it was written in 1938. Yeah. We came across that a lot in rulemaking and trying to figure out, even thinking back to the original purpose. You mentioned waiver as an argument for why a higher standard was needed. At the time, it was a worker protection law, but it was primarily a job creation law. And that waiver language, it was done so that people who were working 60-hour weeks, that the employer would turn it into 2 30-hour-a-week jobs. And you couldn't have the employee and employer waive that and still meet the public policy of job creation. So really interesting to always try and put this law in perspective, because it's such an old law, but still has so many good protections for workers today. So
yeah, and just to amplify your job protection, think of, as I was saying, and we try to make this point in our brief, if you're going to expose employers to having to meet this higher evidentiary burden for, let's be specific, outside salespeople, then the exposure is just, they're facing this exposure that they can't accept from a corporate standpoint, from a bottom line standpoint. So if that's hanging over their head for them having to meet this higher burden, they're just going to say, hey, look, they're just going to eliminate the position, or they're going to make it an independent contractor. And so that runs contra to the, you know, the position you were talking about, the purpose of this, which is, of course, job protection, but job creation as well.
Yeah. So we've kind of danced around it. So what did you think about oral argument? Any interesting hypotheticals or lines of questioning that surprised you?
Mine's surprising. I think there was, again, oral argument, just to break it down from a 30,000 foot view. Let's start with the beginning. It was two versus one. You had petitioner starting off, and it was for me, who's used to hearing arguments that are protracted, delving big summary issues where you're going a lot, you're venturing far and away from necessarily the issue presented. This was a fairly focused oral argument. You know, we're talking, I think it was in and out subsequent to an hour. I mean, an hour was allotted, but it seemed to me listening in on it and listening, it seemed to go very fast. And it was really focused. You got a lot of discussion about appropriateness for evidentiary standards. And so there was some discussion about when you're going to, you know, when you're to apply the preponderance of evidence, when you need to apply clear and convincing, the exception of the clear, you know, the clear and convincing was really the exception to the rule. Unless there is a standard set forth in statute, or unless you're dealing with constitutional or quasi-constitutional, you know, we can get into what quasi-constitutional means. Quasi-constitutional issues, really the default standard, the background standard is the preponderance, is really the preponderance of the evidence. So just, yeah, getting back into it, we had petitioner's arguments very, very, they were all good all along. I talked about a little bit about how the respondent was dealt a tough hand. I'm trying to think of, let's see, some interesting, there was, you know, Justice Kagan wanted to talk about where this came from, how the Fourth Circuit had gotten into it. I think there was the respondent, again, just to come back to what I was talking about before, the respondent in talking about how important the FLSA rights are, how important the FLSA is, how unique it is from a statute, the waivability. I think, again, went down a road where she was talking about, these rights are very important. And I think the justices kind of jumped on that and throwing out hypotheticals. Well, aren't rights under OSHA important? Aren't rights under, you know, Title VII important? How do you distinguish this? And she had to keep coming back to waivability. And then I think counsel for petitioner was able to kind of respond to that by saying, look, you don't necessarily, waivability isn't dispositive for clear and convincing. There are instances where I'm trying to think of what are the other ones. I think she was able to put out, I think it might've been a couple other rights right at the end where she was able in reply, show that look, waivability, there are rights that are conveyed that are unwaivable and still there is the lower standard. So she kind of nailed the waivability. Let's see here. A lot of talk about, you know, what's appropriate standard of proof. I think you're going to get a good takeaway from it. You're going to get a good, you know, just an affirmation that in cases that are, you know, non-monetary, you know, when it's monetary, again, like this, in this case, you're taking monetary damages, you're going to have the lower standard. Let's see here. This is an interesting one. Justice Sotomayor got one of her first questions was, what's going to happen if we rule against you, you know, if we rule this way? And I take that as if you get a procedural question from Justice Sotomayor, that's bad for your, you know, if you're trying to argue against that, it kind of indicates that she's probably made up her mind. So she wanted to get into the hypothetical of what's going to happen here if we remand this. And that fell into, there was a discussion, hey, if this case is remanded, there was a robust factual record. I think they actually had in the district, I think it was Eastern District of Virginia, this arose. Was it Eastern District of Virginia?
It may have been that.
Yeah, it's either Eastern or Western District. It's a DMV case. Excuse me. It's a DMV case. So it was Eastern District of Virginia. So they actually held a bench trial that was 9 days long. So there's a robust factual record. So the justices were concerned with, hey, what if we remand this to the circuit court and the circuit court then remands it back? What's going to happen? Are they going to have to do a new whole trial? Or instead, is the judge just going to be able to, hey, look, I have this Rebecca factual record. I'm just going to apply the higher evidentiary standard or the lower evidentiary standard to the facts already in the record. So there was a lot of discussion about, not a lot of discussion. I mean, there was some discussion about what are the potential avenues if we reverse the Fourth Circuit. Again, as I said before, Justice Kagan was interested in where this came from, whether there was any Supreme Court case law or precedent that had said that these exemptions should be applied. You know, you should apply the higher evidentiary standard. And that wasn't the case. Let me think here. I'm just going to look through my notes if there's any other. I don't think of anything off. That's pretty much it off the top of my head. Again, abbreviated arguments, not abbreviated. I mean, just normal. I'm used to these past 4 or 5 years where these could be long. So very succinct arguments, points well taken by both sides. I think it got across.
So before I read the next question, just a reminder to the audience, please feel free to jump into the Q&A section and ask whatever questions you have. I was going to ask you if you had any predictions, but Robert asked the question better. 9-0, it seems. Who might dissent? Anyone? Seems unlikely.
Yeah. Again, here, just my proviso that this is just me talking. I don't know anything about any of this, anything about where they're going to come down. But I think, yeah, that's about right. When you have, look, let's look at Justice Jackson had a lot of questions. I don't think she was, we'll just break it down. Justice Jackson asked a bunch of questions. I don't think she was moved. Justice Kagan, again, wanted some reassurance that it wasn't going to be inconsistent with past precedent. Justice Sotomayor was talking about the procedural fallout here. What happens if we reverse the Fourth Circuit? So I think judging by that, Justice Alito asked very few questions. Justice Thomas, very few questions. A few questions from Kavanaugh, a few questions from Roberts. I'm trying to think. Nothing jumps out at Gorsuch asking any. I didn't search Control F Gorsuch in the transcript, but I don't remember Gorsuch asking really anything. So I think 9-0 is right on. The fact that obviously you have the government. It's funny, stepping back, I did think it was funny that Landmark Legal Foundation, the organization I work for, and the Biden Solicitor General's office were on the same side of a SCOTUS issue, which so take that for what it's worth. I think the fact that you had the Biden Justice Department arguing for what they were arguing for, I think a 9-0 possibly is in line here. And again, what you were talking about, Cheryl, it's a narrow decision saying remanding it back to the Fourth Circuit, who will in turn remand it back to for the district court to apply the facts here rather than either the Fourth or the Supreme Court. So yeah, let's go out on a ledge and say 9-0 here.
That's bold. I'm going to hold you to that.
Yeah, hold me to it.
I will hold you to it. But I do think, I will also predict, to your point, I think it'll be a very narrow decision. Yeah. I don't think we'll be seeing a lot of long discussions of what this exemption is. I don't think we'll be seeing a lot of narration or dicta on how it should be applied or what they're, I think it'll be a very tight, very direct holding without too much explanation in order to bring all the circuits aligned.
Right. Yeah. Bring all the circuits and all the justices. I mean, Alito, now that when you were talking, I just recalled Alito did ask for a bright line test. He just said, should we apply a bright line test? He was looking for the bright line test application. I don't think, and I think the, was it the government or I think the government responded that that wasn't necessary. That if it's a 9-0, it's going to be tighter, obviously, because you're not going to necessarily have. And, I think the chief likes to see that, a tight decision 9. He'd rather see a tight decision 9-0 than a fragmented decision 6-3. And so I think they might orchestrate that. You might have some concurrences from. It might be a Thomas because he did write Encino Motor. Let's go the next step. I mean, Justice Thomas wrote Encino Motor Cars. I mean, could you envision Justice Thomas writing this decision? This, when I was thinking about this weekend and today, I was thinking about how this is kind of a part two of Encino Motor Cars. You want to have both sides of this. Encino says, hey, look, we're gonna say this is how we're gonna read the statute, and then you have this case with EMD Sales, which is gonna say, okay, this is the applicable standard of proof. So you have both sides of it now covered for FLSA cases. So I think I think maybe Alito, based on his question, might want to see a bright line test, but I don't know if that's quite necessary right now. I think that they're getting to the point where it's pretty clear when you're going to apply these evidentiary standards. I think this is, this is kind of, you're shooting for the moon here, trying to argue that the clear and convincing should be applied. The only time you're going to apply this in monetary damages cases is application of these FLSA exemptions. And you're going to burden employers with this. I think it's probably a really tough road there. So we'll see.
I think one thing that will be interesting to your point about a continuation of Encino, I have heard the argument. So as you know, there are 34 exemptions to the overtime minimum or the overtime in the FLSA, and three of them, the executive administrative professional or the EAP exemptions, are the one people use the most and talk about the most.
Yeah.
Those were the exemptions at issue in Encino. I've heard some argue on the other side, on upper plaintiffs and workers, that Encina was limited to those three exemptions mm-hmm. and didn't apply to all 34 across, with some interesting arguments and really trying to narrow Encina. It will be interesting to see if this decision is written in such a way that, one, they make clear they make it obvious that the preponderance of the evidence does apply to all 34 exemptions and not just the sales per right. sales in front of them. But two, if some of that language also does start to answer the question of, was Encina meant to be narrow for three of 34 or apply generally? I always read Encina as applying generally,
right.
but that argument is out there. So it'll be interesting to see if it's indirectly addressed in this decision.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. And I think you could say if it's applicable to, you know, when you say narrow, you can construe narrowly in so many different ways. The tightest narrow is, yeah, just for outside sales exempt, just this one exemption. But I think you say question presented. Let's go back to the question presented.
Yeah.
Standard of proof must satisfy applicability of FLSA exemption. So I hope that it's not simply outside exemption, you know, outside sales exemption. Obviously take it, but you know, I hope it's applicable to all exemptions. And I think, again, it's, you can reconcile this with the purpose of the FLSA. You know, it's an employer, it's a job creation as well as an employee protection. So you don't want to read it in, you know, reading, applying this higher standard really works against job creation. So I think you could consistently read it in that way. Also, yeah, Encina, what did they do? They rejected legislative history too of it. And you know, so there was a little bit of that.
Yeah, you know, Encina not only talked about a fair rather than narrow reading of the exemption, it also talked about the fact that although this is a remedial statute, you're to read the statute fairly.
Right.
And there's a lot of language around that we thought was important when we did rulemaking during the Trump administration, but there were some who didn't necessarily align with that viewpoint. So that's why I think each of these building blocks is, to your point, creating a better picture of right. how the court sees the statute, even though I think it's fascinating that, you know, there's another FLSA statute that a case that I think was argued last week before the court about, I'm sorry, in Texas about the salary basis test that some people think may end up before the court. So I just think it's fascinating that we have such a robust law written in 1938 that we're still learning what it means in 2024, such a living, breathing statute.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I really appreciated the opportunity to file this, to write this brief and to talk to these employers and talk to individuals out there in the industry and see what really concerns them and why, how these practically, you know, how these decisions practically affect them. And we talked about before, just to go back on the first question, is why is this important? And these decisions, you know, the implications and the effects that these decisions have. And I think to consistently, you know, I think it's interesting whether there was a little bit of discussion about whether it was dispositive, you know, whether there was a harmless error here. Let's just talk about this, whether there's a harmless error in this case. And even if you applied the lower threat, the evidentiary threshold, the employer still, you know, in EMD sales, the employer here didn't meet that burden. And so, well, you know, is the court going to get into that? And I think that we both agree. I think most agree that the Supreme Court's not going to get into that, whether they met that burden. But there was, you know, I believe reading the district court's opinion, I think they mentioned that it was a close case, and that's kind of the facts on these cases. Oftentimes you get a, he said kind of, fact pattern. And if it's a, he said, you know, where are you supposed to go there? So that's interesting. So you have a couple outlets, you know, you have the, I think we're all agree whether they're going to remand this back down using the lower evidentiary threshold. Whether EMD sales ultimately succeed, you know, is an open question. Again, there's a robust factual record here. I think the court was the district court was on one hand, on the other hand kind of argument. So I think their prospects for probably succeeding down at the district court level are probably fairly decent as well.
So, yeah. Well, anybody who has any other final questions, please throw it into the chat. I do want to emphasize, while we're talking about it having been a job creation, it is a very important worker protection law. I can tell you that when I was at the wage and hour division, the cases I would hear would make me sick. And we did have record-breaking recovery for workers who had been really abused and taken advantage of in the workplace. So I do believe this is a very important worker protection law, and don't mean to minimize that in any way. But I think it is a fantastic thing to see that it is a law that's been on the book for 90 years that still protects workers and does good things. So Mike, this has been great. Any final words before we leave?
No, thank you, Cheryl. And I'd like to thank the Federalist Society for the opportunity to talk about this. This has been an exciting case. I think we'll look forward to a decision probably coming in, I'd say probably mid to early spring, maybe mid to late spring. This is probably going to be one of the earlier decisions that's rendered, particularly since oral arguments occurred fairly early. So let's look forward to a decision in this kind of the coming months, and we'll see where we are with it. But thank you to the Federal Society. Thank you, Cheryl. This has been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. This has been so fun. It's been really great to get to know you and learn more about what you do. Thanks to the Federal Society, and thanks to you all for joining us today. We really appreciate you being here. Hopefully we'll get to see some of you in DC this week at the Hilton. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.